Okay, so thank you to everyone who's here in this Zoom session where we're going to be talking with Professor Sharon Dolovich about COVID-19, jail, prison detention, and her amazing and inspiring and very important work on the intersection of those other two things. I think maybe the first place to start is to just ask Professor Dolovich, what is the basic problem that we're seeing that COVID-19 is posing for people in detention?
So, as we all know, the single best way to limit the spread of the virus is social distancing, and people in prisons and jails cannot social distance. For decades, pretty much every prison and jail in this country has been overcrowded, and when you have crowding, people are often sleeping and existing within, inches of each other. Certainly 6 feet between people is impossible. And I would also say that even if prisons were not and jails were not overcrowded, if they were just at capacity, the design, the conceptual design of prisons and jails, even at capacity, would still prohibit social distancing. And then there's a set of problems, a couple of other problems. One is most people in prisons and jails do not have adequate means to keep their hands and their immediate environment clean. So not enough soap, not enough bleach and disinfectants, not enough clean towels and warm water, and certainly no hand sanitizer. And then the other problem is that because of the American carceral system having increased the number, the length of sentence, as well as the number of people in custody over the last 4 decades, we have a disproportionate number of people who are elderly in prison, and in prison years, over 50 is pretty much elderly. And there's also inadequate medical care, and so we have a lot of people who are medically compromised. So you put all those things together, no social distancing, no proper hygiene, and a high-risk population, and you have a potential catastrophe.
So, when the pandemic kind of was widely realized to be imminent and urgent, and all kinds of social practices started changing, how in that first period of social adjustment did these kinds of issues become recognized or not recognized or acted on?
Well, I think advocates, as soon as people started seeing what was coming, I would say, I mean, everybody kind of got figured out at different times, but certainly by the end of February, advocates around the country were already seeing what was coming down the pike, and they were anxious to get people released because really the only way you can protect people inside under these circumstances is to release enough people from the facilities to enable reduced density and social distancing for the people who remain inside. So advocates started pulling every lever they could think of to try to get every state official that has some authority over release, whether in the jails or in the prisons, to A, release people, and then B, to implement best practices. It started out with screening and testing, and there, strategies around cohorting, so trying to reduce the movement within a facility, so trying to get people kind of be in sub communities in the facility. So that those were the initial efforts, and because of the legal environment and also the political environment, frankly, we've had all these decades of tough on crime, and there's a lot of commitment to keeping people in custody no matter what, even if they are low risk for a public safety threat, and even if they are at high risk of contracting a fatal disease. Those dynamics have come together to make it very difficult for advocates to convince public officials to reduce the populations inside.
Okay, so we set the stage. We talked about the challenge that the disease is posing, initial reactions by advocates, which sounds like a lot of clarity among the advocates for the detainees, for the prisoners, about at least some things to do. And then tell us about your intervention in this fast evolving environment.
Yeah, so sort of related to the question you just asked, the first thing that prisons and jails did in response was they canceled visits because it was clear, that the more people in contact with people, the more the virus can spread, and they wanted to reduce the number of people in coming to the facility. So I started, I'm on a listserv with prisoners' rights attorneys, and people just started posting, oh, in my jurisdiction, they just canceled visits. In mine, they canceled visits and they canceled attorney visits. There's all kinds of like a movement on the policy side, but it was just very ad hoc. And so I just thought, oh, I really need to keep track of what's happening. It's too, there's too much information coming in. So I asked my research assistant, Keegan Hawkins, to just create a spreadsheet for me, just a list of all the facilities, which ones have canceled visits, which ones have allowed, and which ones have canceled, which ones have allowed attorney visits. And the other question at the time was, which has compensated with free phone calls and video calls to family, because obviously family connections, especially during a crisis time, are crucial for people inside. And then what happened was, from there, advocates were already crafting demand letters, asks, requests, you know, to governors, to sheriffs, to courts. There were some court filings. And so there was a call out to see if anybody could create a document where people could upload their material so that other people could learn from and borrow from what had already been done, a kind of, you know, document sharing database. And so we said, oh, I've already got this thing going to visit, so let's just add requests. And then as the requests started getting answered, we added a tab on, responses. And then we thought, oh, we should really start figuring out which facilities are screening and testing, and then how many positive test results were coming in. And then, you know, as it moved forward, we added tabs on jail releases and prison releases and deaths, staff and prisoner deaths. They've started. And there were a bunch, you know, we have a massive tab on all the court filings and court orders, and it just kept growing. And so now we have this massive database, which we had as an open source document so people could add information from around the country for the first 4 weeks. And then just last week, we had to shut it down, lock it down, just because there was too much there. And there was a concern that as the document link circulated, people might, you know, there's worry about sabotage, or we didn't know, people making mistakes. We didn't want to accidental erasure of the data. So now we have it as a locked document, but if people have information, they send it to us via COVID-19. Our email is covidbehindbars@law.ucla.edu. And so we're asking people to send us any relevant information to that email, and then we're having people upload it. And I should say, by the way, that this did not happen with just me and Keegan. We now have a massive team. I think we counted people that I'm thinking of as the kind of core team are, I think we're at 12 people now, plus a number of volunteers around the country. And I think we're up to over 20 UCLA students working on the project. And we're about to hire 2 data scientists to help us with web scraping and analyzing the data. So it's exploded in just a very short time, I guess, along with the virus itself.
So one question about that timeline, when the initial information started coming in about kind of closing off the prisons even more to the outside world to prevent visits and to presumably to prevent, at least mitigate the odds that the virus would enter the facilities, did that create at the outset another layer of challenge in terms of figuring out what's happening inside? In other words, there's a kind of a protection that also kind of is frustrating to the purpose of the advocacy. Yeah,
absolutely. I'll highlight 2 ways where that's true. One is, at the beginning, we added a tab on conditions inside, and we wanted to get people to just tell us what's happening in your facility, what's happening in the facility, the people that, you know, that where your clients are or your loved ones are. And that tab was probably the least travel, because I realized it's just hard to get information. And so we were getting other information that advocates were able to secure, and public information like releases. It was hard to get the details of what was happening inside. And the other way this plays out is that, you know, prisons and jails, the administrations control all the information. That's always been true. And there's always been secrecy in facilities, especially since the constitutional, the court has held that the public and the media have no access have no right of access to what goes on in prisons beyond what a warden or a superintendent wants to provide. And that is playing out now in the way that they are controlling the information. So what we are doing is taking data every day from the dashboards that many departments of corrections have set up. And there's no consistency. Many of them are very thin on the data. Most of them don't post deaths, even though we know from other sources that people are starting to die. Some states only have a kind of total of how many people in their entire facility or their entire system have tested positive without a breakdown as to how many in each facility, which is obviously important to know. So there's a ton of missing data. And one of the things we're hoping with our new data science hires, which we're just working on now, is that they will find ways to get behind what's just initially on the web. But it's a sort of, I think it's a microcosm example of what we see just generally in this area, that we need information that is life and death information, and the prison and jail officials are the ones who control it.
And so how are advocates of various stripes using all this information that's been collected so far?
Well, I can't answer that in a comprehensive way because there are people on the site every single day and I don't quite know, they're taking it in all kinds of ways. I can tell you that we have a lot of journalists who come to the site to try to figure out what's going on and to get behind, you know, if they have a particular story in mind, they're looking for information about that. I can give you examples of that. You know, my sense, we certainly have advocates who are constantly using our court filings page and also just the data page to give them a sense of what's going on in their facilities. One of the initiatives that we, created a couple of weeks ago was we created a quick link for judges because we were told that a lot of judges are, first of all, they're getting requests of the court sort they've never seen, and it's emergency. So they're getting emergency requests for release. The law is very unforgiving, and there are not a lot of legal levers that can be pulled. And so advocates are trying different things. And judges who get these cases, many of them want to find a way to provide relief because people will die if they don't. And apparently some of them are having difficulty because the spreadsheet is so complicated and massive. So we created a link everybody can use it. It's on the web main landing page of the program, but it was designed for judges to quickly find, it's just, you know, state and federal cases, individual versus class or group requests, just kind of so that people could judges could quickly find the relevant court orders. So that was another way that the site is being used. And it was another way that we had to react to how we could be useful. And I will say, I want to add one thing, which is this is only happening because we have so many amazing and dedicated and talented people at UCLA Law School. Because whenever I get an ask like this, I don't know how to do it. So I reach out to all the people with skills like Ben Nyblade and Scott McKnight and Kevin Gerson and Rebecca Fordman and Henry Kim. We have a lot of people on the staff who have really mobilized to try to make this as user-friendly as possible.
Wow. And so I know that you've done some writing in this vein, kind of based on some of the information you've gathered. Could you maybe address head on what you think is the appropriate policy response, and also whether you think it's more likely that the appropriate policy response will be achieved politically or through litigation?
So obviously there are a lot of things that prisons should be doing inside, facing people out as much as possible, providing hand sanitizer and other ways that people can keep their areas clean, you know, masks, et cetera. But really the only thing that is going to avert the coming disaster is mass releases. And so, you know, that's of course a problem for the reasons that I said before. There's not a lot of political will to do that. Especially on the prison side, there are not a lot of levers that judges feel like they can pull, even though we know that there are many people in these facilities who are high risk and also who are low public safety threats. You know, if we're talking in California prisons, there are 17,000 medically compromised people who are at high risk. And, you know, these are people, many of them are on walkers, they're on chemotherapy, they have, you know, serious hypertension, obesity, they're also aging, they're older prisoners. So if you put together what we know about recidivism by people, you know, who are in like 40, 50, 60 years old, and you add that together with their incapacity, it's clear that these are not people who are gonna pose a public safety threat. They should just be released, as far as I'm concerned, tomorrow. And then if the question is, how does that happen? And you asked, is it a legal response? Is it a policy response or political response? My view has long been in this field, even before COVID, that there are legal levers that can be pulled if judges are willing to pull them. And the problem is that the political culture has been hostile to anything that seems like it is being soft on people who commit criminal offenses. And so judges, I think, feel like they can't, it's risky to use the law, the levers that I think exist. Also because the Supreme Court has made clear that they're expecting lower courts to be extremely deferential to prison officials. So it turns out that political dynamics really matter. And my own view is, if there is a strong enough political push for action, I think we will see both the governors and other actors on the political side taking action themselves. And also we will see greater willingness on the part of the courts to use the legal hooks that are available to them that they might be reluctant to use at this moment because they just think they'll be slapped down by the higher courts and the political will is not there.
So I have a couple more questions I want to ask, but just to cue our wonderful audience, if people who are listening in live want to chat me questions, I can then relay the questions and we can have a more interactive experience. The last big topic I wanted to make sure we talked about before opening it up had to do with the legacy of this of this aspect of the COVID pandemic. And it's, of course, hard to do a prediction at all, and we're still kind of early in the arc of this historical event. But I wonder if the effort that you've put together to collect information, if to the extent there are releases taking place or will be taking place, the ramifications of seeing that happen and could be viewed as a source of lessons in a lot of different ways, and also maybe the experience of the prison administrators, I have to imagine, is maybe unique here. I imagine a lot of prison administrators are feeling unusually conflicted in the kind of directives that they feel themselves subject to. Maybe they always do, and maybe more so. Maybe some didn't really feel conflicted before, maybe feel more conflicted now because of the exigency here. So I just wonder, on any of those threads or any other thread, where do you think this is going to take us in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so many dimensions. So one of them is that I think we will see, I mean, there already are people being released, kind of the lowest hanging fruit populations, low level offenders. On the prison side, pretty much every facility or every system that I know of has sped up their parole releases. So people who've already been granted parole, who typically have to wait around for 4 months before they can leave, and now they're just being released immediately. So there are different places where we're already starting to see movement. And I think it will become clear that these populations are never needed to be incarcerated in the first place. And I think we're going to see those, there's going to be a legacy there. And I hope that will, there'll be other dimensions of that too. I also think prison officials know who in their facility is safe to release. And I imagine that if you talk to any warden of any facility, even in a high security facility, they would give you a long list of people who they think would be released tomorrow. And I think hopefully there'll be that knowledge will be mobilized in a way now that, you know, that will then show us that we can use it in the future. And there are other couple of legacy points. One of them is in terms of our database. One of them is there's going to be a lot of legal liability for failure to act. And it's unclear, I mean, it's my sense, it's unclear how that will play out actually in the courts, but I think there's going to be a lot of action after the fact on failure to protect. And so for our thinking about our database, I want our database to be a resource for those people who are trying to, who in the future will be trying to reconstruct what happened and what was known when. So I'm hoping the data will be a legacy in that way. And then the other thing is that part of what I'm thinking of is, you know, there's going to be a lot of, I think of as knowledge production coming out of this period. We're going to be studying this period and what happened on every dimension for decades to come. And I'm hoping that our database will just be useful to academics and historians and legal scholars and anybody who wants to reconstruct the, you know, trajectory of all of this.
Yeah, the point about constructing the history and the raw materials for the history and liability, I think, are really well taken points. Is there a widespread effort, you think, by people who are in detention to get their message out, despite the somewhat new, somewhat longstanding restrictions on disseminating that information?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, cell phones are contraband in prisons and jails. And there's always this dance between the officials and the incarcerated people, because everybody knows they have cell phones, many of which are brought in by staff. And periodically in any facility, the officials will come and confiscate them all, and they have to buy them all over again. And what we're seeing now is we're starting to see people using their cell phones to stream video. There was one really powerful recording that came out of Elkin Federal Prison in Ohio, which is now the subject of a court order for broad releases, because there's such a high number. You know, I think 8 people have died in the facility already, and they're not testing enough, so they can't. They're saying the numbers are really low in terms of the infection rate, but it's clear that's not happening. And that was one of the things that I think is moving the ball in that facility, was that video that was sort of smuggled out by a incarcerated person. So I'm not sure if that answers, if that was what you were thinking of when you asked the question, but. That, and, you know, of course, family members, as always, are trying to communicate with loved ones inside and then get the word out. I myself have gotten emails from people saying, you know, my mother, my sister, my brother is looking for compassionate release. How do I help them? And there's now this growing network of people who are, you know, all hands on deck in this area. And so I was able to send, you know, I got one email from somebody whose mother's in federal prison and is medically compromised, and I was able to send the email to the person, the member of the federal defenders who has been every night aggregating all of the cases that of that day and sending them around, and he was able to get it to the right person. So there's a growing network of people who are just trying at every level, kind of at individual level, at the group or class level, to try to move the needle on this.
And do you have a read on how medical facilities in the prisons are reacting? Because you can imagine, I mean, there are all kinds of strains and failures, and some of them, I guess, are easy to imagine. But I just wondered, do you have a sense of that? Is that, yeah?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, my sense is that in facilities where it's really hit, it's overwhelmed their medical facilities. And, you know, in prisons, if you have an emergency need, most, you know, if the clinics inside are to treat kind of the day-to-day of health management, but if you have any kind of emergency, you're sent out to the communities. And one of the things advocates have been pushing on to get a public response and pushing, you know, for action on this is to emphasize that when people in custody go into respiratory distress because of COVID, they're going to be sent to the local hospitals. And if you have, as they all, you know, many facilities are becoming cluster hotspots, and if you have many people who are going to need your respirators, that's fewer respirators available for other people in the community. So I think it's important to recognize that the medical burden is not going to remain within the four walls of any facility. It's going to, prisons are part of society, and it's going to draw on local hospital resources.
So essentially there's a general public health argument for fostering public health in the facilities.
Massive. I mean, right now, I think in Ohio, the prisons are the biggest source of infection. Cook County Jail is the biggest source of infection, I think, in Illinois. I mean, what we're seeing, the tragedy that we're seeing unfold in nursing homes around the country is, I think, about to be replicated in the prisons, because in both kinds of facilities, you have people who are not able to care for themselves, in nursing homes because they're, you know, not physically able, and in prisons because they're locked down and can't leave. And then you have insufficient staffing to care for everybody and the impossibility of social distancing in both institutions. And I think what we're seeing in nursing homes, we're going to start seeing more of in prisons.
Wow. Well, do you want to offer a final thought? Those are the main questions I had. And I really think this is so important, and it's so hard when one's own life is thrown in the confusion. It's so hard to find something to latch on to that can be productive and that can contribute. And I think you've done an incredible job of that in real time.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I would say a few things. One of them is, this is just to emphasize, this has been a team effort. So, you know, our colleague Aaron Littman is working with me hand in glove on this, and many, you know, Rebecca Forden in the Law Library has spearheaded the legal filings piece of it. There's just a lot of people at UCLA and outside around the country who are looking to help or helping us, and we can always use more help. So, you know, I would just put out a call, let me know if there's any, you know, if you want to contribute in any way. And I guess the other thing I would say is, I think this is a good kind of illustration of the way that legal advocacy has many dimensions, and it's always a team effort. And, you know, there are people, there are experienced prisoners' rights attorneys on the front lines right now who are going into court. And there's a community of lawyers who are, you know, sharing ideas and information. And then there's those of us who are supporting them. And the data collection piece of it is crucial. So it's gratifying to be able to participate in the work, even if we are not going to court, even for the people who are not going to court every day to try to bring about the change we need to see.
And as you discussed before, it's work that is not just instrumental to all the different legal dimensions of the problem, but to the creation of history, to political activity, to all kinds of aspects of this issue. So I see we have a question from the group, and the question is, about data on which arguments advocates have made and which ones seem to be getting traction so far. If you can.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I can say that we don't yet have the tools to answer it, because the court orders are coming in thick and fast. I would say there's nothing that's emerged. Advocates are trying all kinds of things. There's nothing that's emerged that has finished a clear win in any particular jurisdiction. As you might imagine, it depends on the court. It depends on the on the nature of the ask, it depends on the jurisdiction. So for example, in Texas, a district court a few days ago issued an order, a detailed order directing the Texas Department of Criminal Justice to undertake a number, this wasn't a release order, it was an improvement of conditions in the facility order, basically best practices, a detailed order around best practices to limit the spread of COVID among the people who are still inside. And just yesterday, in fact, I haven't had a chance to read all of it, the Fifth Circuit just reversed the order. It was a grant of a preliminary injunction, and the circuit just reversed it, which gives you a sense. I mean, I say this to my classes, in my prison law class, especially now because we're talking about this in class, this is lawyering in real time, and things are just unfolding. I will say that a short-term goal of mine, and we're about to bring on a couple of law students this summer, the research assistants, and their project is going to be trying to answer the question that was asked, getting a feel for who's been, you know, what arguments have advocates been trying, what has gotten traction, what hasn't. I think the one frustrating thing, as my comments have already alluded to, is it's not as if the quality of the legal argument is determining the success. It's just, as we know, courts are very, you know, the process of legal decision making is also political, and they're trying to navigate many different shoals, including the worry about a reversal from a higher court. And so my guess is we're not going to see that any one argument emerges. It's that different courts have been willing to accept arguments that other courts have not been willing to accept.
So I think very related to that last point. So we have another question that's been asked that has to do with, I think, something that's simultaneously a very legitimate and real worry that I think you've already kind of addressed to some extent earlier. And on the one hand, and the other, on the other hand, something that is a kind of political shoal or a political challenge, and that is the possibility, real or anticipated, of people who have been released pursuant to one of these initiatives committing crimes later, and then legitimately or maybe out of proportion being subject to media attention. And so I think the question is about whether, if you could speak to that and the challenge that, to some extent, it's a pervasive challenge in the area. And pervasively a legitimate concern, which I think explains why you were focusing on certain releases earlier.
I think it's a totally fair and understandable and appropriate question. And here's what I would say. Thing number one is, nobody is suggesting that prisons and jails just open their doors and let everybody out willy-nilly, right? They have information. They know what crimes people are charged with. They know, you know, in longer-term facilities, they know their behavior in the facilities. So as I suggested, prisons in particular know about the relative danger posed by the people inside. And in every facility, officials are doing their best to identify the people who can be safely released. I happen to think that we have many more people in custody that ought to be in custody, and many people who, even people who have been convicted of crimes that are labeled violent, are not dangerous people. But if we are trying in a very short time to identify populations of people who could be safely released without massive political backlash that would prevent further releases that we need in order to keep people alive, then I think the right thing to do is to look for people who are lower level offenders and lower risk. The other thing I will say is that it is certain that some of the people that we release are going to commit new crimes. And what do we do about that? Well, I guess what I would say there is, you know, one response might be to say, oh, we think that people might commit new crimes, it's likely to happen, therefore we won't let anybody else out. We won't let anybody out. But that has this kind of fantasy dimension to it, that there won't be a major harm if we do nothing. And I guess the point is, either way, there's a risk involved. On the one hand, if we release people, you know, in the way that we're doing, some of those people may go on to commit more crimes. On the other hand, if we don't release people, we know for a certainty that people who have not been sentenced to death for their crimes will die of COVID inside. And the numbers are likely to be quite large. So it seems to me that we can't lose sight of the fact that we are now in a, not just a second best or third best, but a 50th best scenario, or however low you can go on the numbers. And everything we're doing is risky. It's true, it's risky. But the question is, where does the greater risk lie? And my own view is, given the certainty of death for, you know, vulnerable people inside, and likely, you know, scores if not hundreds or thousands, we don't know where this is gonna go. Given that on the other hand, we can, for the most part, get it right on who is likely not to be a danger to society, and recognizing that there's no risk-free place to land, I think we absolutely have to proceed the way we're proceeding, notwithstanding that some people might commit crimes. funds once they're released.
So one other question that you made me think of in your answer, and then I think unless there's, or maybe fit one more question if someone else has one in the chat. But the thing you made me think about in more detail is the predicament of the, not just the managers or wardens of the facilities themselves, but the guards, the union members, people who are kind of in the middle, literally, of the challenges, the health challenges, and also the prisoners who, for whatever reason, maybe for the reasons that you suggest, are not released, maybe correctly not released. And so what is the attitude of the guards, I guess, is one question, to the extent that they are trying to quite understandably protect themselves and their families, to what extent will the kind of release order you contemplate protect the guards and also the prisoners who are not released?
Yeah, I'm so glad you made this point. The staff are in a very dangerous situation right now, because they are, and their families too, because they come into the facility every day. I mean, there's a prison in Ohio, the governor of Ohio ordered all the prisoners in the state to be tested, and there's one facility that was found to have 2,000 people with the virus. And you know, when you have a facility with that high of, you know, not many people infected, basically everybody's gonna end up infected. And so the staff come in, they move through the facilities every day with their masks, admittedly, but you know, there's close quarters. They're also in close quarters. They can't socially distance from people inside. That's not how a prison works. And so they're exposed. They spread it around the facility, and then they take it home to their families. And they're, and you know, whoever else their family is in contact with, hopefully they're all social distancing, but still. So they are in real danger, and staff have started dying. Staff has been dying already, and there will be more. And I think everything, the same things that we can do to protect the people inside, the incarcerated people, will also protect the staff. And so for those people, I know there are people who just don't care about what happens to people who are incarcerated, you know, pretrial, charged with crimes, or in prison serving punishment for crimes. But perhaps those people might be moved by the risk that we are putting the staff in every day when we have them going to facilities that are likely, you know, hotbeds of the virus, and they're just trying to do their job every day.
Well, thank you for all these remarks. So just to kind of sign us off here, I'm Richard Ray. We're speaking, or have spoken, with Professor Sharon Dolovich. And could you just say the resource that you created? I think you mentioned before, but just so people who have listened this long can get it loud and clear at the end.
So the project is the UCLA COVID-19 Behind Bars Data Project. The email address, if you have information you want to add to the database, is covidbehindbars@law.ucla.edu. And I can actually drop the link into the document in the chat, and so people can, I'll do that right now. And people, if they want to look at the database, they can go to it.
Wonderful. And we can include it when we post the video as well.
Great. There's the link to the to the database. So thanks to everybody for your interest.
Yeah, thank you again so much. And yes, thanks to our audience and questioners as well. All right. Stay safe, everyone. Bye-bye.